Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-5403. Hine, Hetinga, et al., Appellants versus United States of America. Mr. Riccardi for the appellants, Mr. Bagley for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. The night before the Hetigas were going forward with a legal challenge to a decision by the department, Congress passed the Milk Regulatory Equity Act, which targeted them specifically, which punished them for their past lawful conduct in operating their businesses. As a result, a three-count complaint was filed based upon a facial constitutional challenge to the actions of Congress. Rather than accept the well-pled allegations of the complaint, the court effectively rewrote the claim as a challenge to a federal milk marketing order and a discretionless implementation of congressional directive by the Secretary of Agriculture. And so the single issue presented for this appeal is whether an obligation that's imposed by Congress in mandatory language, as to which the government official, in this case the department, Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, charged with the implementation, had no discretion, is subject to immediate review in the federal court for violation of the Bill of Attainder Clause as well as other constitutional provisions.
Isn't there an antecedent question, namely whether you should have exhausted your administrative remedies?
That's an issue that the court found, and the question becomes whether or not there is a requirement for exhaustion of an administrative remedy in a case where all that occurs is a challenge to the actions of Congress. And by definition, since a bill of attainder claim can only be violated by Congress, and any potential administrative remedy is not what was sought here, and in fact is not applicable, then the plaintiffs were not required to exhaust administrative remedies in this case.
Your problem is that we have an in-point circuit precedent, Edeline, that the government relies on, which says that this very statute, you must exhaust your administrative remedies. Now, I assume you'll say, well, this is a constitutional claim, right?
I'm not going to say that, Judge Tatel. What I'm going to say is this.
What are you going to say about Edeline, then?
I'm going to tell you why Edeline is distinctive.
Uh-huh.
And not only is it distinguishable, but it also shows why I have a constitutional claim. In Edeline, one of the three producer handlers in the Pacific Northwest, who was part of an underlying hearing in which my client was involved, challenged the amended regulation by the Secretary of Agriculture. That was the challenge that was raised. What happened in the interim was Congress passed the Milk Regulatory Equity Act, which targeted my clients, which precluded them from challenging the underlying regulation. So the distinction is, in Edeline, what we have is an amended regulation challenged by a producer handler, and here we're not challenging any regulation. What we're challenging instead is the action of Congress in passing the Milk Regulatory Equity Act against my clients, which, among other things, precludes them from doing anything.
But you are subject to, and now I'm looking at the language of the statute, your client is subject to an obligation imposed in connection with a milk marketing order, right?
Ultimately, that's true.
No, but it's not ultimately. That is the fact, right?
But
your client is subject to an obligation imposed, in connection with a milk marketing order.
And that obligation.
And that's what the statute says you must. And we've ruled in Edeline that those challenges of those kinds must be brought
You ruled in Edelene that way, and you had an amended regulation, but what you didn't have was a situation like this one, where Congress has mandated, and all that the Secretary did through a discretionless act was to impose the specific terms.
In other words, as I understand Judge Tatel's point, is wouldn't the court, in order to rule in your favor, have to decide that the statutory requirement for exhaustion is not a jurisdictional requirement?
Well, if we need to get there, but I don't think the court has to go in that direction.
Well, if it's a jurisdictional requirement, how can you avoid it?
If it's a jurisdictional requirement, you couldn't avoid it. It's not a jurisdictional requirement if the court takes a look at the Avocados Plus case, because the language in the Avocado Act is almost identical to the language at issue here. And what the court in Avocados Plus found was that it wasn't jurisdictional because there was no sweeping indirect language.
Well, but it's a different statute. I mean, we have a two-year-old precedent that says this statute requires exhaustion.
You do have a two-year-old precedent, but that two-year-old precedent relates to the issue of whether or not someone is challenging a milk marketing order. What you don't have is a situation or any case that says, in fact, Forichich says the opposite, that somehow because of the fact that there's some implementation of a congressional directive, as in Forichich, in that case it was custody order that would end up being decided by the Superior Court in D.C., that before challenging Congress and doing what it did, you somehow had to challenge the actions of the judge. Or in Consolidated Edison, that before you could challenge what the state legislature did, that somehow you had to go challenge the implementing agency, or somehow in Lovett, before you challenge the decision by Congress, you'd have to challenge the failure to go ahead and pay money by the agency.
You'll admit, will you not, that in those three cases, they don't address the issue that we have here, namely what Judge Tatel has been discussing with you.
It doesn't, but quite frankly, on the bill of attainder issue, whether it has to do with a custody order or a nuclear regulatory issue or milk, the fact is, it's still a question of whether or not Congress violated my client's constitutional rights in the first instance.
You agree with respect to exhaustion that Congress could require exhaustion of this kind of constitutional claim?
Congress could have, if in fact.
And so the question then becomes interpretation of the statutory language that Judge Tatel identified, 15A.
That's correct.
And there, it does say any obligation imposed in connection therewith. It doesn't say any obligation imposed by the agency or by the secretary in connection therewith.
It doesn't, but it says any obligation.
And thus the plain language seems to encompass or potentially encompass obligations imposed by a statute as well.
Potentially it does. On the other hand, if you look at the exact language, it talks about essentially imposed by the agency. And more importantly, if you look
those are the three words you're reading into it, which may be correct, but that's not exactly what it says. It just says any obligation imposed in connection therewith.
Judge Kavanaugh, that's true. But go back and look at the Ruzicka case. And what it says is the purpose for that statute was to go ahead and correct abuses or errors by the agency.
Right. I'm aware of that language, but I was just focusing on the text here. And what sense would it make to have constitutional challenges to the agency actions to be funneled through the administrative process, but then a very similar in substance challenge to what was going on in Edelene, although to the obligations imposed by the statute, not go through that process?
Well, the reason that it makes sense to do it this way is if there's imposition by Congress and a challenge to its action as a violation of the Bill of Attainder, what we find out is, and you have that before you, is that the agency can't do anything about that.
Well, you also have a due process and equal protection challenge.
Do.
And those could be fleshed out in a way that would facilitate judicial review. Is that not correct?
It's not correct, because if you take a look at the information in front of you, what you'll find out is when I filed an action, a prophylactic action to protect my client's rights, what the department said in response was, one, we couldn't do anything other than what Congress told us to do. Two, we have no power to go ahead and declare a statute unconstitutional in its answer. And now the administrative law judge has confirmed that very point and stated specifically there is no remedy my clients can get with regard to that constitutional issue in the administrative process, and said another court has to make that decision. That's this court.
Let me ask the question this way. We have Edeline. Edeline says, looking at the language of the statute and precedent, that this is jurisdictional, that you must exhaust these remedies, and the court wouldn't even consider any excuse. So do you know of any case where we or any court has so interpreted a statute yet then created an exception for constitutional claims over which the agency could not provide any remedy?
Well, first of all, I have two responses to that. The Avocados Plus case interprets the language of the Avocados Act, which is identical to the 15A provision
here. Right, but that doesn't help you because it's a different statute, and we have Edeline, which is this statute, and our obligation is to follow the case that's most in point, and that's Edeline.
And if Edeline, I've given you the distinction in Edeline, number one, but number two, the reason that you have no other cases is because fact of the matter is Bill of Attainder cases are not everyday garden variety matters.
Well,
they are, in fact, cases that come over once in a while.
Well, the government does cite a couple of cases for the proposition that you have to exhaust even if it's a constitutional claim. And Thunder Basin, Supreme Court case.
And actually, in Thunder Basin and other cases, I distinguished them in the brief. Those are issues where there was an issue of regulation and an interpretation of regulation by an administrative agency. Even if it falls within that, in the administrative agency process, that argument would work, but not where there's an actual act of Congress where the challenge is to what they did.
You don't know of any case, then, that supports what you're asking us to do here?
Well, actually, Forotich and the other Bill of Attainder cases all support that position because of the fact that they allow direct action against the Congress, even though there's implementation by other agencies.
Let me ask you, can you get any mileage out of Edeline's discussion of what it describes as a narrow exception under Stark?
You could, if what we were attempting to do is to find a claim for the fact that my client is a producer handler and was bringing this case in its producer capacity. I don't need to go there because the precedents that I've given you, the Forotich case and others, where the direct challenge is a facial constitutional matter and where now we have the administrative body stating specifically that I can't get the relief that my client needs. This is the only forum in which, by its definition, a constitutional claim can be asserted for violation of the Bill of Attainder.
Would your argument be the same if you didn't have a Bill of Attainder clause claim and just a due process and equal protection?
It would be the same because it's still a constitutional issue, but the gravamen of the case is a Bill of Attainder claim, which by its definition can only be violated by Congress.
Well, back to these exceptions. Edeline noticed, did it not, that there was access to an administrative remedy.
There's a recognition,
and
Judge.
I thought your argument is that there may be an administrative process, but it can provide you no remedy.
And you did put your finger on it, and if I haven't articulated it, I will now. The fact is, Edeline does recognize that in that case, there is an administrative remedy available to that plaintiff. Here, there is no administrative remedy. The administrative remedy has already been stated as unavailable. The ALJ cannot declare the statute unconstitutional, and that is the very remedy that we seek.
Well, what is your understanding then of the government's argument that, well, the secretary could set aside this order that directly affects your client?
Well, they may say it, but the practical reality is when trying to deal with that issue, they specifically stated it was imposed by Congress. We can't change it. The language in the MREA says it can't be modified with regard to my clients. And therefore, under the circumstances, there is no available remedy.
Didn't the district court here say that that the agency could grant relief here by eliminating the milk marketing order?
The district court said that there was a hypothetical, but the district court did not go ahead and look at the exact language of the MREA, and I am out
Well,
of my
is that a possibility?
I thought the government was picking up on, that the district court said the secretary could set aside the order.
What the district court said was that there's some hypothetical power out there, but what the district court didn't look at was the very terms of the MREA, and what the district court didn't have in front of it is what we know now in reality, that they've got the government stating specifically that they can't do anything because the fact is it was imposed by Congress, and they can't even change or modify the terms, which is the very issue of filing a 15A. If there's no modification or variance available, then how is it that this is really an available remedy to my clients?
All right. Why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Nicholas Bagley for the United States. In their complaint, plaintiffs explained that they challenged their subjection to, quote, the pricing and pooling requirements of the local federal milk marketing order. The AMAA, in turn, provides a mechanism for the administrative exhaustion of, quote, any obligations imposed in connection with a milk marketing order.
What could the Secretary do?
What could the Secretary do?
Yes.
Well, as we acknowledge in our brief, the Secretary can't overrule or invalidate the MREA, but the Secretary can create a record that would aid this court in reviewing the claims that are asserted in this.
Well, but that record could be created in the district court simply by the agency testifying.
Well, it's true.
Or through the brief. You don't need an administrative hearing for that.
You don't need one for that, but right. Congress established an administrative review mechanism, and Congress's express requirement that those get channeled through the Secretary in the first instance, you know, should be respected.
When you say express requirement, I don't read the statute as expressly requiring challenges to statutes.
Got it.
To go through an administrative process. So that's point one. And then point two, are you aware of other cases where Congress or the courts have required exhaustion of constitutional challenges to statutes?
As to your first point, I think the statute is very clear that any challenge to obligations imposed in connection with a milk marketing order have to get channeled through. And as the Supreme Court explained in Ruzicka, that's so even if the challenge is framed in constitutional terms. Your second point,
right.
whether or not you
can have two kinds of constitutional challenges, right? The constitutional challenge to the agency action, that clearly can be funneled through the administrative process. The separate issue and the issue that I think is squarely before us is whether a constitutional challenge to the statute itself, right. A facial challenge.
Well, maybe I'll take it from the other side, because I know of no case where this court has accepted an exhaustion requirement when it was pitched in constitutional terms.
You know, constitutional
not, well,
terms
don't put it in terms any, of. Yeah, I'm sorry. Good. Yes. Good, Brent. I'm sorry.
Any case that you're aware of, Supreme Court or any court?
In Thunder Basin, the court was very, very careful to explain that even if the agency could give no relief on the constitutional claim that's alleged, even if that's true, the claim still has to be funneled through the administrative exhaustion provision.
Yeah,
and as you asked earlier to opposing counsel, there's really no dispute here that Congress could have channeled these disputes.
But it's very unusual, is my point.
Well,
in
milk
fact,
regulatory,
maybe
the milk regulatory context is pretty unusual. I mean, this is a extremely technical, extremely complicated regulatory scheme, and it's one that the courts have insisted over the course of 70 years. These disputes have got to go to the Secretary in the first instance. Because
well, if that were the case on this kind of claim, you would have a precedent, but you don't have a precedent.
I think it's important to keep in mind that what plaintiffs have attempted to do here is really atomize their claim. To get out from under the pricing and pooling obligations of the Arizona milk marketing order, Sarah Farms has got to challenge two things. It's got to challenge the MREA, and it's got to challenge the underlying order, the February 24th order that preceded the MREA.
I don't understand. If the court held that it was a statute, it was a bill of attainder, how could the order stand?
There's a pre-existing order that actually the Secretary said went through the whole 9 yards of the administrative review process and said,
we think this serves... A final rule?
A final rule, yes. On February 24th, 2006, it was implemented. And this is in our brief.
And the final rule could stand in face of a court determination?
The final rule preceded this and would not be subject to the same bill of attainder or due process infirmities that the MREA would be.
Well,
I should note in this connection.
Just to be clear here, the appellants did start before the agency in challenging the final rule.
They did, and in fact, after the MREA was enacted, they filed a separate petition challenging the February 24th order. What they did, though, was file two separate petitions. They said, I got an idea. What we're going to try to do is set one challenge to the regulation.
Right. So
the second we're going to split it off and do a whole separate challenge that.
But isn't that exactly what you're saying they must do? That even if they prevail in court, you're saying they have to go back to the secretary and get the order.
What I'm saying is it would have been a good idea in the first instance to bring a single claim, raising both challenges.
It would have been a good idea, but were they required to do it?
I think under the language of the exhaustion requirement, they were. I mean, the exhaustion requirement of the AMAA is quite broad. It says that any obligation imposed in connection with a milk marketing order is subject to an exhaustion.
Suppose they just had a challenge to the statute, though. I mean, you're using the facts of this case to say, well, it would make sense here. But suppose all they had was a challenge to the statute.
It's hard for me to understand why it would be that this court would set aside the plain language of a exhaustion requirement to craft an exception to a generally applicable rule that in most cases serves this court and litigants very well.
Well, let me try to get at that question a different way, okay? The statute, I think you have to agree, the statute it creates an administrative forum, but it doesn't require exhaustion is a precondition of judicial review, right? I mean, there are lots of statutes that do that, and this statute doesn't do that.
I would want to be careful about that. I think on its face, and if this were enacted today, I think that's right. But this is a statute that's been around for 70 years and subject to a long history.
Correct, and we've interpreted this most recently in Edeline as requiring exhaustion as a condition of judicial review, right?
That's right.
Okay, so the requirement that the requirement of exhaustion as a condition for judicial review is a judicially created one, correct?
I don't believe in this context that's right. Because again, I think the statute has been subject to 70 years of interpretation.
Where 70 years of interpretation by the courts. I mean, it's the courts that have ruled that you must exhaust and that there's no exceptions.
I think the courts have ruled that Congress has channeled these disputes.
But we've interpreted the statute on its face doesn't require. I mean, we have many statutes that do require exhaustion, and this one doesn't do it. It just creates a remedy, administrative forum, right?
I think that that's on its face, and again, if it were enacted today, that would be right. But I think if you look at the language of the statute, you have to consider the way it's been interpreted over the course of 70 years.
Assume I didn't agree with you about that. Assume, just for purposes of discussion, that I thought the mandatory aspects of this, of exhaustion here, come from judicial interpretations of the statute.
Okay.
Given that, aren't we just as free to say, look, we've required exhaustion as a condition for judicial review when that exhaustion would help the process, but whereas here, there's nothing the agency could do. Forget whether it's constitutional or not. The fact is there isn't anything the agency could do to provide relief here that we wouldn't interpret it that way. Wouldn't we be free to do that?
I think you wouldn't because of Edeline Derry.
In Edeline, none of the claims that were made were claims for which the agency could provide no relief.
There was a claim that administrative exhaustion should be excused because it would be futile. And that's precisely the claim that
The agency wouldn't rule for them, not because the agency couldn't rule for them.
I think that's a distinction without a difference.
But it's a major difference in terms of whether we're looking at whether administrative exhaustion can or can't help the judicial process.
Well, then I think that, you know, assuming you leave Edeline Derry to one side, which I think, again, is instructive on this point, I think exhaustion here would serve several purposes. But
deal with the exception that Edeline speaks of, citing the Supreme Court decision in Stark.
I'd be happy to. First of all, that argument that the plaintiffs are suing their capacity as producers has not been made. It's been waived. Even if it had been made, that's not accurate. The pooling obligations to which they object apply only in their capacity as handlers. To go back to Judge Tatel's question about whether
exhaustion... Did that answer my question as to Stark?
Yeah, Stark, I'm sorry, I should go back.
In other words, Stark was Edelian has been suggested as saying you have to exhaust no matter what the nature of your claim, regardless mm-hmm. of whether you can get any relief. Yet Edelian recognized that there was an exception where there could be no admission.
So I'll take a step back. The Stark exception arises from the language of the exhaustion provision, which starts, any handler subject to an order. And so the Stark court said, well, geez, we've got some producers here in front of us. What do we do with them? And they said, well, you know, we don't believe that Congress meant to deprive them of a remedy, and so we're going to allow them to come to court. This court has made it clear that when you're suing in your capacity as a handler, which is, again, what plaintiffs are doing here, you're going to have to go through the administrative exhaustion requirement.
Well, I think it's interesting that in Edelian, the court didn't distinguish Stark on that rationale.
I think
said there were two reasons that the Supreme Court in Stark had held there was an exception. One, there were some personal rights, and two, there was an administrative remedy available.
No, there wasn't one available because
I'm saying they did not have access to an administrative remedy.
That's because the exhaustion provision of the AMAA
right.
is specifically limited to handlers. And
right.
so these producers couldn't take advantage of an administrative exhaustion requirement that by its terms wouldn't have encompassed their claims.
Precisely. So here we have a situation where in whatever capacity they're suing in, they claim they can't get any relief from the Secretary. And your brief suggests the Secretary could set aside the marketing order.
Our brief doesn't suggest that. The amicus brief does, and
sorry,
the district court accepted me. That. But the more important point
do
is—
Do you not agree with that, by the way?
No, I mean, I think it's an important—
No, did you not put it in your brief because you think they're wrong?
I don't think it's wrong. I think it's unlikely to happen.
Yeah. Okay.
I wouldn't want
right.
to belabor the point. Right. I think, you know, one thing that we need to take a step back and think about here is what we're trying to do is craft a rule of general application. We're not trying to craft exceptions to that rule, you know, simply because litigants atomize their claims. And
well, again, they atomize their claims. Suppose the, I'm not sure about that. Suppose the statute, the exhaustion statute said in the key language, any obligation imposed by the Secretary in connection therewith.
We would have a very different case here.
Okay. So it really does turn on whether you interpret that language of the statute to refer to the Secretary.
With a very important caveat that we're not just interpreting this language, we're interpreting 70 years of case law that has consistently interpreted.
Well, the 70 years of case law really just changes the word may to must.
Fair enough.
So that's a separate point that you were discussing.
We would have
with
a different
Judge
case
Tatum.
And we'd have a different set of arguments. But I think here, recourse to the plain language of the exhaustion requirements.
And then going back to that same point, you agree that if it said imposed by the Secretary in connection therewith, it'd be a very different case. Why isn't that the better reading of this language in the context of the whole provision, which really is directed to the Secretary and orders that are...
I think that's a great question, and actually gets me back to an earlier question that Judge Tatel asked, which is, you know, why don't we add in some words that Congress didn't use because that would better serve the purposes of the statute?
That wasn't my question.
No,
that's a good
way
to frame it.
I'm going to get back to it. I haven't put those words in your mouth.
That was a clever way to frame it.
But if you were going to do that, you might do that because you thought there was no purpose to be served by exhaustion. And this is where I get back to Judge Tatel's earlier question. I think in the mine run of cases, you're going to have a lot of – the Secretary is going to be able to offer a lot of insight into the particular challenges that petitioners raise, even if in the end of the day the Secretary can't or won't give the relief requested. Here, the Secretary could have, in its administrative hearings, held hearings. And, in fact, USDA asked the ALJ to hold hearings on – whether or not, in fact, this statutory provision applied only to plaintiffs, on whether or not the MREA served any non-punitive purpose.
Why can't they just tell us that in a brief?
I suppose they could, Your Honor.
Well, of course they could. I mean, why do we have to go through a whole administrative hearing just to get that clear, that simple
fact as to whether there's any other dairies
that are covered?
If there is a factual dispute, the question isn't whether you have to go through an administrative
process.
Well,
does anybody disagree
whether you have to go
about
through
whether
one
there's,
or the other?
Does anybody... Is there any doubt that this is the only dairy covered?
There is some doubt. Because of confidentiality concerns and other concerns, I'm not at liberty to speak more broadly to that, but there is some confusion as to whether or not this is going to apply more broadly.
There are secret dairies in this state?
I think the point is that you know what we have here is a rule of general application, and our job is not to look for reasons to set it aside. Our job is to think whether or not the rule, as a general matter, makes good sense. And I think the case law and common sense suggests that it does. And in those circumstances where Congress has established by its plain language.
How long do you think the administrative process would take?
The judicial officer in this case ruled a week ago, and that has terminated.
Now, the whole from start to finish of the administrative process, what's the best estimate?
Well, I can tell you, in this particular case, it took a year, start to finish.
Let me ask you about Thunder Basin. We were talking about that a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
You said that the court said you had to exhaust even if the agency couldn't provide a remedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that's right. In Thunder Basin, the argument was that there was a due process problem created by having to go through the administrative process,
mm-hmm.
that the company would either have to violate the rule and face penalties, right, or comply and face irreparable injury.
Mm-hmm.
And the agency could easily solve that problem, right, by not requiring compliance until after the hearing. So the agency could have granted relief there that could have avoided the constitutional problem.
Hypothetically, they could have, just like hypothetically the agency here could have blown up the milk marketing orders. I think the point is...
Well, but it's more than hypothetical. It says, here's the court says, quote, the commission may grant temporary relief pending review of most orders and must expedite review when necessary. So the court didn't think that was hypothetical at all.
I think, again, the point is not, I mean, let's assume in Thunder Basin it was more hypothetical.
Let's assume that it was
not very likely that the agency would do it. The very fact that there is a possibility that the agency could provide relief is
But in Thunder Basin, the agency had the power to correct the precise problem that the petitioner was challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, the agency doesn't. True, the agency could, I suppose, as you said, hypothetically eliminate the milk marketing order, but that's not the relief the plaintiff is seeking here. The plaintiff is arguing that this is an unconstitutional bill of attainder, and we all agree the agency can't do anything about that.
I think that this court has been very clear that administrative exhaustion serves many purposes, one of which is that the agency can sometimes provide your relief and obviate the need for future judicial proceedings.
Well,
but others of which is that the agency...
Suppose it can't.
I said one of which. I think there are other purposes of exhaustion that would be served in this case. But again, the point is not that this particular case is the best case for exhaustion, that it says that I would be up here saying, gosh, this is precisely the reason we have these exhaustion
requirements. But that's going to be true in most cases, or maybe all cases, where there's a constitutional challenge to the statute, that it's not really going to make sense to require exhaustion. In other words, the interpretation of the statute as referring to actions taken by the secretary really links up nicely with the futility exception, because it is going to be futile to bring a constitutional challenge to a statute before an agency.
Which is what Adeline Derry squarely forecloses, the futility argument or consideration of a futility argument. I think that's sort of the first answer to your question. I go back to the language of the exhaustion requirement, which is clear on its face that any obligations imposed in connection. And, you know, I think it's going to be difficult in most cases to always piece out whether or not somebody is raising a facial constitutional challenge or whether or not, in fact, the agency can provide relief. You know, here, you know, they've raised a particular kind of facial challenge the agency is not going to be able to do a great deal about.
You know, the statute says any handler subject to an order may file.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even say shall.
That has been subject to 70 years of interpretation and this court's recent decision.
Well, that's Adeline. That's my point about it's the courts that have interpreted it.
The courts have interpreted it as what Congress said.
In
the same way that you'd say if you were interpreting a jurisdictional requirement that is held to be jurisdictional, your interpretation of that would be a judicial interpretation, but it wouldn't change the source of authority that underlay that statute, right? You'd still say Congress is the one
directed
it.
I agree with that. The courts have never addressed the question of whether Congress intended to require exhaustion when the agency couldn't provide a remedy. That's what we have.
I mean, that's a pretty fine level of detail.
It seems to me pretty fundamental in terms of why you have exhaustion.
Again, one of the purposes of exhaustion is whether or not you can provide relief.
Yeah.
But let's assume that there's a case. Let's assume the possibility of eliminating the milk marketing order was a little less hypothetical, mm-hmm. right? Was something that was potentially on the table, right? And which I know the plaintiffs didn't even ask for that, although that would provide them precisely the same relief. If that were a more meaningful possibility than this facial constitutional challenge, address it.
And that goes to why bringing a facial constitutional challenge is a long shot in constitutional litigation, in other words, on the merits of their constitutional claim, because there would be ways to defend that in court to say, well, there's various
kinds of relief. But wouldn't you want the Secretary to be able to actually inform that kind of determination? Because it could, the Secretary could say, look, as applied in this particular context, it's really not a problematic, and I can explain to you why in the context of this very complicated regulatory scheme. But, you know, again, this is an unusual case, but I think because this is an unusual case, you want to keep your eye on the ball, which is the general rule that's laid out in the exhaustion
provision. By the way, I'm not sure this would be relevant, but are you aware of any indications in legislative history that Congress intended challenges to statutes to be covered by this language in 15A?
I'm unaware of any. You know, it's, again, a very old statute.
I'm aware, yeah.
I'm curious. I realize you rely on Adeline, but what do you make of the language in the Avocado decision which suggests that Ruzicka is wrong?
I would say a few things. First is, you know, whether or not it's jurisdictional, I think it's not a question that we need to get into. Second, even if we do need to get into it, you know, it's just kind of offhanded discussion of why Ruzicka might be wrong is dicta that doesn't bind this court. At any rate, you know, it distinguishes the Avocados Act, which was before it, from the Milk Marketing Act. It said, look, the Avocado Act is really about...
No, I realize it did that, but it went on for its final reason. It did. It said the statutes were different, and it talked about the complex administrative screen, but in the end of it, it does say it doubts that avocado under current law is any longer correct.
I have fewer doubts on that score, and I, you know, would urge this court to go back to the history of the administrative exhaustion provision, to go back to Ruzicka, to go to Block, where the Supreme Court said that the administrative exhaustion under the AMAA was in effect jurisdictional and bypassed a standing inquiry to get to that, which suggests, again, that was about the core power of the courts to review that issue. Whatever the court said in Avocados Plus, they were dealing with a very different statute and a very different scheme. And again, I don't believe this court needs to reach that question.
What about the Weinstein v. Salvi line of cases?
I'm sorry. A Weinberger against Salvi.
Saying that, you know, the harm that's at issue here is the statute itself. And so when you talk about the fundamental purposes of administrative exhaustion, where the Secretary has no discretion. I mean, Congress has just removed an exemption here, and that's what's being challenged. How is the purpose
of exhaustion
met on, yeah.
This court has explained that administrative exhaustion serves the purpose of perhaps allowing the agency to give relief and obviate the need for judicial review. Setting that to one side, they also have explained that administrative exhaustion allows a record to be built up for the court that would aid in judicial review, and we've explained in our brief why that would be.
And you suggested that even if this were briefed in court, certain information could not be shared with the court?
You know, at that point, we'd have to make determinations about, we'd probably have a factual hearing and have confidentiality arguments hashed out.
That could all be done in court.
It could be, but the question is, I mean, it's going to have to be done somewhere, and Congress has said this should be done in front of the Secretary in the first instance. So the fact that it could be done in court, I don't think detracts from the force of our argument. I note also this court has said that administrative exhaustion serves judicial economy. And again, as I explained earlier in my argument, there are actually sort of two moving pieces here, both of which are subject to administrative challenge, and both of which should be channeled through the Secretary in the first instance. If the court has no further questions.
I just want to ask one other quick question here. So it's the government's position that because there may be a factual dispute as to whether or not the plaintiffs have been singled out, that it is that factual dispute that could be resolved
at
the administrative process, and it's preferable to have it resolved there because the nature of the information is such that the Secretary's expertise would somehow come into play?
I think that would be one of the purposes that would be served by exhausting. I don't believe this court needs to even think about that question. Adeline Derry is very clear that exhaustion is a mandatory requirement, notwithstanding equitable exceptions that you might craft.
Well, you know, I may be the only person left who wants to look at these holdings in the context they're raised in the case, but I mean, we're talking about marketing orders there.
In Adeline?
You're saying here there's a marketing order that you sort of want to ignore, that the Secretary is just performing a ministerial duty.
I'm not sure I'd characterize it as a ministerial duty. Enforcing this order is a monumental regulatory
undertaking.
Not enforcing,
issuing.
Well, but issuing the regulation itself is no mean task. You had to go back and reissue every single one of the 13 local milk marketing orders. The MREA is itself subject to interpretation. You know, this isn't simply, you know, stamping a library book when you hand it out. This is a...
I'm not counting how many cows and how many gallons and all that sort of thing.
I'm not saying it's the hardest thing the Secretary has ever done.
All right.
I wouldn't say that it's a ministerial task.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. We ask that the district court's order be affirmed.
All right. Counsel, give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Several points. First of all, so hopefully I can clarify this fairly quickly. A question was asked, I think, by you, Judge Rogers, about what happens to the plaintiffs in this case. Do they have to go back effectively to another administrative remedy? Let's remember where we are. This wasn't atomized. The reason it was filed this way is because Congress stepped in the day before we were challenging something and put the imposition of this statute in our way. And two things are true. One, with regard to Sarah Farms itself, we still have to go back and deal ultimately with the department on the underlying 3 million pound limitation. And we have a case set aside to end up doing that. But the problem is the statute in place, the MREA, makes it clear that the Secretary cannot grant us any exemption from the statute. So we can't even effectively challenge it because the MREA is an impediment. Secondly, GH processing, this is the first time that GH has been regulated. There's no underlying issue. There's no information from the department. And in fact, if the MREA was lifted from GH, GH could go ahead and operate as it had. And there's no requirement that it would have to end up challenging anything anywhere else. But more importantly, let's get back to where we really are. It is a bill of attainder case where the imposition of it was in a non-discretionary act by the agency. And the National Home Builders case, which we cite, states that, in fact, it cannot be the agency action because the agency itself, in those circumstances, is not the proximate cause of the harm. So that it is clearly the act of Congress itself under the terms of the Bill of Attainder and the other constitutional provisions that we are challenging. And there is no case where anyone has been required in a Bill of Attainder claim where it's a facial challenge to go through and challenge agency action in an administrative remedy. Nowhere.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.